payment. I get my email back. We received your application. We processed your payment. Piece of cake. Easy peasy. Thank you, God, that this is so simple. Next day, Sandra gets her email. You've been approved. Everything's good. Next day, I don't get my email. Second day, still don't get my email. Third day, fourth day, what's going on? I don't understand. Fifth day, I get an email. Your application has been deferred. Deferred? What does deferred mean? In order to approve your application, we need only three things. One, we need the name of the tour guide company that you're doing your travel with. Two, we need a copy of the itinerary to show all the sites that you're going to be visiting while you're on your tour. Three, we need a copy of the plane ticket that shows when you're leaving Uganda to come back to the United States. Uh-oh. I don't have these. I'm never going to have these. I will never be able to give them to Uganda. What does that mean for my application? Confusion. Chaos. What is going on? Why does Sandra get approved with the exact information and I don't? Do they know something about me? Why does everybody get approved who's ever gone through this process except me? You wonder, because you don't understand. So, I took a cop, sent the email, I forwarded it to Danlin. She's the one who does all this stuff. She's the one who put together the handbook. She's the expert. She knows this. Danlin, look at this email I received. They said I'm deferred. Am I in trouble? Am I going to get approved here? What's going on with this? Danlin sends back a reassuring email. Don't worry. It's happened to one other person. It's okay. All you need to do is just wait a day. And then go back into the application like you're going to modify it, like you're actually going to give them the information that they're asking for, but don't change anything, don't add anything, just hit resubmit, and you'll get approved. You've got to be kidding me. Are you kidding? Is this what it means, third world? I mean, is this what third world government does? Is this the way it works? So I thought, okay, well, at least we've got a solution. At least we're going to bring a little order into this chaotic development. So I wait a day, and I get online, and I got the application ID that the Ugandan email sent me, and I've got my passport number, and I've got all the information they need to so they can look up my application. I put it all in, and I go, find application. And I sit there, and there's a pop-up. It says, please wait. Below the pop-up, it says, don't touch any buttons. Don't exit. It could take a little while. Okay, I'll wait. That thing. Please wait. Please wait. That's what I felt like doing to the computer. Please wait. Please wait. Please wait, please wait, please wait. I'm tired of waiting. I don't want to wait anymore. Stop telling me to wait. I want to hit a button. Stop telling me to wait. Please wait, please wait. New pop-up. We can't find your application. Are you kidding me? You can't find my application. You sent me the email with the application ID. How can you not find my application? So then you start to problem solve. All right, well, I'll try a different search site. Instead of going on Safari, I'll try it on Chrome. Please wait, please wait. We can't find your application. What do I do? So I waited a day. Please wait. I waited. I tried the link on the email. They sent me an email with to modify it. Here's the link. Boom, hit the link. Please wait. We can't find your application. Maybe they sent me the wrong application ID. So I sent an email to the Ugandan immigration thing. Hey, you just want to confirm, is this my application ID? Can you find it? I did this. They sent it back, same application ID, on the same link and everything. Hit the link, can't find your application. Are you kidding me? What is going on here? There is no explanation for this. How could this be happening? They know my application is there. They gave me the ID for it. How can it not be found? It's just chaos. Well, as it turns out, the Bible has stories about dealing with confusion and chaos. The funny thing about the Bible stories about confusion and chaos is that sometimes you find them in places that you would not expect to find them. Going to look at Exodus 20, verses 22 through 26. This isn't a place where we would normally expect to find anything. This has to do with the law. Background behind this story is that the people of Israel have been in Egypt. They've been slaves in Egypt for 400 years. God has redeemed them, rescued them from Egypt, sending all the plagues against Pharaoh and against Egypt's gods. And he has brought them out, and they have traveled through the wilderness for about 50 days. And they have camped at Mount Sinai. And we know this event as one of the feasts that Pastor Rick tells us about, the Moedim that he's telling us about. This is the Feast of Pentecost. This is where the Lord gave Torah to the people of Israel. And that's what we're in the middle of. So at Mount Sinai, God has appeared to the people of Israel in all of his wonder and glory. And he has spoken to them in his power and his majesty. And he has spoken the Ten Commandments to them. And in response to this, the people are saying, this is too much for us. We cannot take God in all of his power. This is overwhelming to us. Moses, you go deal with it. You go talk to God. And so Moses has gone up to Mount Sinai, and he is there, and this is where our story takes place. And so what we see in Exodus chapter 20, verse 22, what it tells us is that the Lord said to Moses, thus you shall say to the people of Israel. You, people of Israel, you have seen for yourselves that I have talked to you, with you, from heaven. You shall not make gods of silver to be with me, nor shall you make for yourselves gods of gold. An altar of earth you shall make for me, and sacrifice on it your burnt offerings and your peace offerings, your sheep and your oxen. And in every place where I cause my name to be remembered, I will come to you and be you and bless you. Now, if you make me an altar of stone, you should not build it with hewn stones, for if you wield your tool on it, you profane it. You shall not go up by steps to my altar, that your nakedness be not exposed on it. And that's where we'll end the Bible passage. And as we look at this, we look at it with the eyes of 21st century Americans. Pastor Rick has told us what this means. He told us when we look at the world, when we experience the world, we do it with an abstract perception. We do it with consideration of our ideas and concepts about the world. We look at it abstractly. And so when we come to passages like this, we take our abstract perspective and we see that, oh, this is about the law. And when we look at our Bibles, we will see that there are headings over passages in our Bibles that help us in our abstract understanding. And so we may see things on as a heading above this passage as law about idols and altars, or the law about altars. And so this reinforces this concept, this idea of it's the law. And we know what the law is. The law is rules. And the rules say to us, okay, this is what you should do. This is how to be obedient. And this is what you should not do. And if you do what you're not supposed to do, then you're guilty. And so we look at it with our abstract perspective. We look at the law as it's about right and wrong. And when we see this passage, it confirms our perception because it tells us right and wrong. It says, you shall not make. We shouldn't make gods of silver, idols. We shouldn't make gods of gold, more idols. Okay, got it. Don't make idols. And then with an altar, it tells us, okay, altar of earth, got that. We make altar of earth, we shall make. But when it comes to altars of stone, we don't make those with hewn stones. We don't make those with cut stones. We don't make those with stones where we take tools and we chisel the stones and we shape the stones. Okay, we don't make altars that way. Right? Wrong. That's the way we understand it. The problem, though, is that there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of application to our lives today. We don't live in a culture where we're making a bunch of idols, little figurines and statuettes, and say, oh, these are your gods. We don't live like that. We don't live in a culture where there's altars all over the place and sacrifices and everything like that. So it's like, okay, this was a law for the Israelites. This was a law for people from a long time ago. This was a law that applied to them in their ancient cultures, and there's really no application for us today. Now, we can take concepts and ideas with our abstract perspective from this, and we can look at it and go, oh, when we look at the laws, we can say, oh, they're kind of similar to the laws that we have. And so that what must be what it means when they say that we're from a Judeo-Christian culture, and we can kind of understand that. And then also, we can take biblical teaching and theological teaching from this. We can say, oh, well, the law taught the people of Israel about sin. We see that in Romans 7. The law itself is good, but because we cannot do what we're supposed to do, as Paul tells us, and we do the things that we're not supposed to do, the law taught us about sin and how with sin we fall short of God. Okay, got that idea, got that concept, got that theology, and there we go. The problem is that the law isn't just one short passage of five verses. If we would continue in Exodus, we would see lots and lots of chapters of law. And then if we would go to Leviticus, holy smokes, the entire book is law. And so what happens is we take these large chunks of the Bible and we kind of ignore it. If you go into a Christian bookstore, you don't see the shelf devoted to commentary on Leviticus. Nobody's out there buying that. When we get our daily devotionals, we don't see passages where they're quoting from the law, scripture from the law. We don't do anything with this. And so we take it and we kind of ignore it. It's God's word, but yet we kind of remove God out of it because it's about an ancient people, an ancient law. And it really doesn't have a whole lot to do with me today. But if we can try to change our perspective, if we can try to stop being 21st century Americans with this abstract approach toward understanding the Bible, and maybe, just maybe, use our imagination to think, what might it have been like for the people of Israel to hear this? Maybe, just maybe, there might be a little bit more. And so Pastor Rick has taught us, he has taught us how the people of Israel, they weren't abstract thinkers, they were concrete thinkers. As concrete thinkers, they didn't approach the world with ideas and concepts. They approached the world with their experiences. They approached the world through their actions. So if we look at this passage that way, what experience is this passage talk about? What actions are involved here? And we see that, well, it's the act of making silver gods, making gods of gold, making altars. Now we know these aren't real gods, they're pagan gods, it's not our god. It says gods of silver, they aren't really gods. We know these are figurines, these are statuettes. And from archaeology and the discovery of the artifacts, we can see what these statuettes and these figurines look like, especially the Egyptian ones. Because the people of Israel, they've got an Egyptian mindset. They've been exposed to Egyptian culture for 400 years. They've only been away for 50 days. So when it says gods of silver, gods of gold, they're going to be thinking in terms of the Egyptian culture. And we can see from the Egyptian artifacts that we have is that these things were pretty impressive. These weren't just the little arts and crafts cut out things with some scissors and a glue gun. These things are works of art, these statuettes and these figurines. And that's the way they're classified today when we talk about them. It's the art of Egypt. And when we look at it, we see that to make these gods of silver, to make these gods of gold, required skill. It required care. It would have required fine tools and training and understanding. And so when someone is making one of these, they aren't just slapping something together. They're putting themselves into this. They're putting their time into these things. They're putting their care. They're crafting. They're devoting themselves to this. In making these gods of silver, in making these gods of gold, they're worshiping. It's an act of worship. We find the same thing when it comes to the altars. In Egypt, there were altars everywhere. They had big altars and small altars. They had altars in their houses. They had them in their palaces. They had them in their public buildings. They had them in their pyramids. They had altars everywhere. And again, these altars, these are works of art. These altars are things that, just like with the gods of silver and gold, the idols, the statuettes, the figurines, that it would have taken skill. It would have taken care. When it says no hewn stones, it's a cut stone, it's a carved stone. They're not talking about a hewn stone and don't wield a tool on it, as in don't blast it with a jackhammer. That isn't what they mean. Don't use a pickaxe or a sledgehammer on the thing. That isn't what they're talking about. The tools that would have been used to cut these stones, to carve these stones, would have been delicate tools. They would have been chisels of different sizes, different qualities, for different cuts. They would have been picks. They would have been hammers of different weight. We get an idea of what it would mean when we look at the sculptures in our culture, when you go back and you consider what Michelangelo did with stone. That gives us a hint of what we're talking about here. These altars would have been works of art. It's an act of care. It's an act of skill. It's an act of devotion. It's an act of worship. And God is saying to them, don't do this. Don't give me your skill. Don't give me your training. Don't give me your devotion. Don't give me your worship. This had to be confusing to them. What do you mean? What do you mean? Do you understand what I'm doing here? Do you understand how I'm serving you? Do you understand how I'm giving to you? Do you understand how I'm honoring you? I'm not trying to dishonor you. I'm not trying to blaspheme. I'm trying to honor you. Why don't you want this? And God adds more to it. He says, if you use your tool on this, it's profane. Profane? We get the word profanity from profane, same root. Profane means unsacred, unholy, unworthy. My skill, my craft, my time, my planning, my care, my devotion, my worship is unholy. It's unsacred. What? What do you mean? And we start to wonder, and as we start to wonder, we start to question. What's going on here? We start to question God. What's going on here with you, God? What kind of a God are you that does not want this from me? And because he doesn't want it, we start to feel shame. Here I am, I'm trying to honor you, and I receive shame. And in the process of receiving shame, it's even magnified because look at what God says he wants. An altar of earth you shall make for me. An altar of earth. An altar of earth. An altar of earth? You mean you want me to go outside and just pile up a bunch of dirt. And that's what you're saying you want. You want a dirt pile instead of my work of art? Just a dirt pile? And if you make me an altar of stone, stone where I haven't used any tools. In other words, a pile of rocks. A stack of rocks. Great. You just don't want my idols. You don't want my statues. You don't want my gods. You don't want my altars. You don't want my art. You don't want my care. You don't want my time and devotion and worship. Instead, you want a pile of dirt and a stack of rocks. How am I going to feel? How do I feel now? Worthless. Shameful. I feel like a sinner. And so where we get in our abstract perception of right and wrong and the law, they get from their experience. And from their everyday actions. But more than that, it goes beyond shame. It goes beyond shame of sin. Because we're tying it to Egypt and Egyptian culture and Egyptian religious practices. And what we can see is that these idols and altars served a purpose within Egyptian culture. The Egyptians, when they looked at the world, they saw the physical world, but in all of the physical world, they saw spiritual forces. When they looked at the sun, they saw the sun that kept them warm, but they also saw the god of the sun, the spiritual force behind the sun. When they looked at the Nile, they saw the Nile and the river and it flowing and all that kind of a thing, but they also saw the god of the Nile. And with their ground and the crops and with their cattle. And so when you look at Egyptian culture, that's why they have all these gods. Because in everything that's in the physical world, they associated a spiritual pagan god with it. And when they looked at the physical world and when they experienced the physical world, they saw the chaos and confusion of the physical world. They saw the Nile and how normally the Nile would drop silt and fertilize the ground. But there were also times where the Nile would just act in total chaos and confusion and flood the crops. The sun could be warm, but it could also bake and destroy and dry up. Winds would come and just bring sand that would blow everywhere and it would cover crops. And fill houses. Just destruction. Complete chaos and calamity because of this physical world, because of their, from their perspective, the spiritual forces behind the physical world. And so when they worshiped their gods, when they made these gods of silver and gods of gold, these idols, when they did their religious practices on these altars and when they crafted these altars, they made these things to try to get control over the gods who were behind all of this chaos, behind all of this confusion that could be brought into the world when the physical world didn't behave the way that they wanted it to behave. When the physical world did not follow the pattern that they were used to. And so we see that in their religious practices, how their religious practices are designed to please their gods, how they're designed to appease their gods, to pacify them, to make them happy, to reward them so that these gods that they perceived in the physical world would then be happy with them. And if their perceived gods were happy with them, then the physical world would behave in a way that they wanted the physical world to behave. The Nile would stay within its banks when it's supposed to and fertilize the land in the way that it was supposed to. The cows would grow fat and be productive instead of getting skinny and diseased. And the Bible teaches us how this works. In Genesis, there's the story about Joseph and Pharaoh. And Pharaoh has this dream. He has these dreams. And when we look at these dreams, we can see that they really look more like nightmares than dreams. He's got these dreams about cows. And they're big, fat, plump cows. But then after a while, they turn into skinny, emaciated cows. And the confusion over what's going on with these cows. And Pharaoh is wanting an answer because he's seeing in his dream, he's thinking, well, the gods must be talking to me. They must be telling me something. I need to have an answer. These skinny, diseased cows, I mean, what does this mean? What does this chaos, confusion, what's going to be happening? And so we can see how the Egyptian culture worked. Because Pharaoh, being faced with this dream, with this nightmare that he does not understand, with these spiritual forces from his perspective that he does not understand, he goes to the people who he thinks will understand them. He goes to his advisors. Now, we would understand, we could give different words for his advisors. His advisors would be his priests. They would be his magicians. They would be his wizards. He goes to them to explain what is going on with these dreams. Because in the Egyptian culture, it was the advisors, it was the priests and the magicians and the wizards who knew the proper way to make the gods happy. They knew the right prayers. They knew the right ceremonies. They knew the right songs. They knew what you're supposed to do on this kind of an altar. They knew what silver god this silver god would solve, what problem this god of gold would solve. They knew all of this stuff. They were the experts. They knew how to bring order into chaos, into this chaos. They could clear up the confusion. So Pharaoh goes to his advisors, and what the Bible tells us is the advisors really didn't know. They took guesses, but Pharaoh's going, no, that's not right. And as it turns out, there is a man who does know. It's Joseph. He's the Hebrew who's down in prison. And Pharaoh hears about him and he brings it up. And that's because the God of the universe, the God of creation, our God, gave Joseph the ability to understand what this was about. And he's able to tell Pharaoh. And he's saying, well, it's going to be good for a while and then we're going to have a famine. And we see Egyptian culture responding in a way that Egyptian culture responded. They said, okay, I now understand. I now have control. I now get it, and I can get order into an area that these spiritual forces are trying to turn into chaos. And so, Joseph, based on your advice, what we'll do is, okay, well, we're getting these good crops and plentiful harvests and everything. We'll store up a bunch of grain and everything will be good. And then when the famine comes, these skinny cows in my dream, when they show up, then we'll have plenty of food that's been saved for everybody. So instead of experiencing the calamity and the chaos and the disorder from famine and starvation, we're good. We've got order. We've got food. Everything is right with the world. We conquered the spiritual forces. And so that was the entire goal. That was the perspective of Egyptians and how they were supposed to deal with this world and how they were supposed to operate in this world. And so if we come back to our law about altars and idols, if we come back to what it is that God is teaching the people of Israel at this time, Look at what he's saying. He isn't just saying your idols and your altars are of no worth to me, and that you should feel shame. You should understand what sin is. What he's saying to them is, you have no power. This stuff that you're doing, it means nothing. And so the people who are being told, I don't want your art, I don't want your craft, I don't want your skill or your devotion or worship. Instead, I would rather have a pile of dirt and a stack of rocks. The people are being told, you aren't just worthless, you're helpless. You can't do this on your own. And the people would feel not just worthless, not just helpless, but also hopeless. I can't do this on my own. If I can't do this on my own, how's it going to be done? What does this mean for me? What does it mean for my life? Does this mean I'm just relegated to a life of chaos? To a life of confusion? To a life of disorder? Is that what this means for me? That's the experience of this law. But let's go back and let's look at what God says to them on the basis of this experience. You have seen for yourselves. In other words, you have in your own experience, in your own sensory perceptions, in your own life as you live on this day-to-day existence of this earth, you have seen. It's not some abstract idea. It's not just some nice concept that's out there. It's very real and in your face. You have seen for yourselves that I, the God of the universe, the creator of all things, in all my wonder and majesty and power that you just experienced, that was so incredible you had to back away from and send up Moses to talk to me. You have seen for yourselves that I talked with you from heaven. God talked with them. And there's something very significant in what God is saying here. God is saying, I talked with you. You did not talk with me. I talked with you. You did not call me. You did not summon me. I came of my own will, of my own power, and talked to you. What else does God say? God says, in every place where I caused my name to be remembered, I caused my name, God says. His name to be remembered because he caused his name to be remembered. His name to be remembered not because we have an altar there that tells us to remember God, not because we have idols sitting there telling us to remember God. We know how this works. We know how this works. We have historical monuments all over this country, plaques, monuments. They explain date, this happened, so and so. We know how this works. We know how we as people cause things to be remembered. Same thing here. God is saying, your gods of silver, your gods of gold, your altars are not causing my name to be remembered. My name is being remembered because I cause my name to be remembered. I talk with you. I cause my name to be remembered. I am the source of power, not you. I am the one who exercises my will. You do not tell me what to do. You do not control me. You do not manipulate me. You do not appease me. I have my will, and it's by my will that things are done. That's the message that's being sent to these people who feel worthless and helpless and hopeless. And it may not be a message that they really want to hear. God's will, not mine. That is terrifying. So terrifying that when you're faced to it, and you're faced with God in all of His glory, you just want to fall down on the ground as if you're dead. And that's what we see all over the Bible when people are faced with God's glory, is that they just fall on the ground as if they're dead. When you are confronted with the terror of what it means inside of our soul, inside of our heart, God's will, not mine. But God doesn't stop there. Wherever, in every place that I cause my name to be remembered, I will come to you. God is not some distant, abstract deity who sits off where we can never approach Him. He's a personal God. He's a God that comes to be with us. And when He comes to be with us, He will bless us. He will bless us of His own will. Not because of our art, not because of our skill, not because of our time or everything that we do to try to honor Him. He's going to bless us out of His mercy. He's going to bless us out of His grace. Despite the fact that we're worthless, despite the fact that we're helpless and hopeless, He is going to come to us. He is going to talk with us. He is going to be with us, and He is going to bless us. And that's the experience of this law. That's what God is teaching them about Himself in this rule about idols and altars. That's how God exists in His law. And it's not just for the Israelites, an ancient people, 3,500 years ago. It's for us today. So I'm sitting and staring at my computer. And they can't find my application. They can't find my application no matter where I try to find it, no matter which search engine I use, no matter which computer I try to search it on. And I'm completely confused. And I'm telling Sandra this, and I don't know what to do. And finally, Sandra just gets up. She goes over to the computer, and she prays. She puts the information in. She says, find application. And it says, please wait. And then a minute later, it says, here's your application. Can you explain that? So, I did exactly what Dan Lin told us to do. I don't change a thing. There's the button, resubmit. Boom, resubmit. Order restored. Problem solved. Confusion ended. The next day, I don't get that email that confirms that the application was received. That's okay. Maybe it's different this time. Second day, don't get that email and I don't get an approval. Third day, fourth day, fifth day, nothing. 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 Sandra, what's going on here? You prayed over it. Nothing? It popped up. Nothing? Did it get lost again? Where is this? What's going on? I talked with Kelly on the phone and told him about this and other things that were going on and everything. And or actually, we didn't talk on the phone. It was just, it's WhatsApp. We're sending texts back and forth. And he says, we need to talk. So, you know, I tell him, I don't know what's going on with this visa, and that's just part of it. He says, we've got to talk. And so we set a time for Wednesday last week. We're going to, you know, it's Ugandan time. I mean, it's 11 hours difference. You got to plan these things. And so we did. And so we got this time. We're all set up. It's going to be Wednesday morning, which is nighttime there, and it's morning us, and it doesn't matter. This thing hasn't shown up. It's been a week. So right before the phone call is going to start, I thought, all right, fine. Tried it one more time. Looked at it, popped up the application, and there, at the top of the application in green letters, your application has been approved. Here's the approval letter. It's like 5 minutes before I'm supposed to have this phone call. Are you kidding me? How do you explain these kinds of things? You can't. How do you understand these things? You can't. You don't know what's going on. It's not part of our experience. And when faced with these things, we want to get mad. We feel helpless. And we wonder if there's any hope. And we want to control. I wanted to push the buttons and exit, even though it was, please wait, don't push any buttons. I wanted to throw the computer. It was hard. I don't understand. I wanted to be able to have little silver idols and little gods of gold that would give me the comfort of, oh, well, at least this gives me something to do. Because I kept trying all these different things to do. But the cool thing about all of this is that even though all this was going on, and even though all these thoughts are in the back of my head, I felt peace. Because I knew that I'm supposed to be there. I knew that this is where God has called us, and I know that I'm going to end up there. And even though I don't understand it, it's just going to work out. I didn't know how it was going to work out, but I just had this peace about it. And so I didn't get annoyed, and I didn't throw things, and it was okay. And I could laugh at it. I could make fun of myself as I'm making fun of myself as I'm standing up here. Because God's got it, and it's okay. Even if I don't understand how God's got it. And we see that when we look at verses, we can see how this, people understood this. They understood this from their experiences that God's got it. Paul, in his first letter to the Corinthians, in chapter 14, verse 33, he tells us that the Lord is not the author of confusion. God isn't creating whatever it is that was going on with the Ugandan immigration website. God isn't causing all of this chaos. The chaos is there because we're in a fallen world. We're in a world that's separated from God, and things just don't work the way that they're supposed to. And it's a tough world. It's a world filled with disease. It's a world filled with death. And it's just a tough world. It's a world where we get confused. It's a world where we really hurt. This is not fun being here. God is not the author of confusion. 1 Corinthians 14:33 tells us, He's the author of peace. He's the author of peace understood as shalom. Peace that comes from being complete. The peace that comes from being completely satisfied. Even though we're in confusion, even though we're in chaos, we have peace. There's a little poster that I remember that, you know, from growing up and everything, and it says that tranquility is not freedom from the storm, it's peace amidst the storm. This is a truth of God. We live in this fallen world. It's chaotic and it's confusing and we don't understand it. The things that can happen to us can be very hurtful and very painful. But we can still have shalom. We have shalom not because of our power, not because of our craft, our skill, our training, our devotion, or our worship. We have peace because God comes to us wherever his name is remembered, and he blesses us. That's why we have peace. And so as we look at this today, as we apply the teaching of this law to us today, this understanding of God and experience of God that this law teaches us, as we apply it to our lives today, we can ask ourselves, today, when we are faced with the confusion and chaos of this world, do we try to control God? Absolutely, we do. I've had to look at my prayers, my prayer life. My prayers are my devotion, and they're my worship of God. But in my prayers, am I just telling God what he's supposed to do? As I'm asking him, heal, bless, give, am I just being like the Egyptian? Am I just trying to get power over God? Control over God? Manipulation of God? This is the problem, and this is how you're supposed to solve it? Because if you do it this way, if you do it my way, then I'm going to feel like my life is in order? I've had to look real seriously at my prayers. Have you ever bargained with God? If you do this, then God, I'll do this. You know, God, if you let me win the lottery, I promise I'll give a lot of money away to people and it'll be really good and they'll be blessed. Do we bargain with God? In bargaining with God, aren't we trying to control God? Aren't we trying to exercise power over God? Aren't we acting like the Egyptians? And how are we responding when it doesn't go quite the way we think God is supposed to do it? When my wife prayed over the application and it went in and I still had to wait almost a week before I finally found out it was approved? How do we react? Do we feel worthless, helpless, hopeless, angry? How do we react? Are we learning from God in this in the way that God wants to teach us? Are we trusting God in this? Are we trusting him to talk with us? Are we trusting him to come to us? Are we trusting that he is going to bless us? Are we trusting that he is the author of peace? The author of shalom, who doesn't give us freedom from the chaos and disorder of this world, but he gives us his peace amidst this world. He gives us his peace that passes all understanding. All of our concepts, all of our ideas, all of our plans, His peace passes all of that. But more than just trying to control God in prayers or bargains or overt ways, are we also trying to control God in ways that we would think of as passive aggressive? These ways, there's nothing wrong with this. We aren't being disobedient. There's nothing that we should feel guilty of. What I'm talking about is our plans, our habits, our routines, our concepts of who we are. Are we somehow using these things to keep God at a distance, to keep God in a box so that we control how much of God really comes into our lives? I absolutely have faith in God. I absolutely believe in God. But I've got a really busy schedule, and Sunday mornings, you know, I'm just going to go in and go. And that's it. I believe in God. Everything's good. But I've just got too much going on. I really don't want to talk to anybody there. I don't want to get involved. I love what they do there. I like the message. I like the songs and everything, and that's good. But that's enough for me. I've got all these other things going on. Have we put God in a box? Have we used our habit, our plans, our practices, our routines to say, this is where you belong, God, and I've got all these other things going on? You know, that'd be really cool to go to that men's fellowship on Saturday morning, but hey, Saturday morning's the time that I sleep in. That's my routine. This is what I do. You know, it's just like, if they want me to come to the men's fellowship, well, they just need to change the time. Then I'll come. Is that controlling God? Are we using a routine to control God? This is just who I am. This is the way I do things. This is the way I want the worship service to go. This is the kind of church I want to go to. And if I can't find a church that fits what I want, then I'm not going to go. Is this controlling God? Nothing is wrong with any of these things. There's nothing to feel guilty about with any of these things. We aren't hurting anybody. We aren't breaking any laws. It's fine. What are other ways we try to control? With our finances, with our budgets. There's nothing wrong with any of this stuff. But in the process, are we somehow limiting our giving? Are we spending too much on ourselves? What are all the ways that we control God? What are all the ways that we try to get God to do what it is that we want Him to do? With our health, with our kids. And that's something I've certainly had to learn in going to Africa. Sandra has shared with you, this was something that hit her heart, the idea of going and being a missionary somewhere. It's been in her heart for a long time, with me not so much. Serving God in the church, in the local church and all that kind of thing, absolutely. But leaving the country and doing it, not so much. Because I don't camp. And everything I hear about is that if you leave this country, you're going to lose the comforts and you got to camp. I don't camp. Holiday Inn is camping. Give me the Sheraton. I'm not going to find the Sheraton in Jinja, Uganda. And I just didn't see it happening. But God is God. And God blesses. And there's this place there that's amazing, in which they make it possible for me, someone who is not handy, who doesn't know how to do plumbing, who won't be able to fix the electricity, who would die in the wilderness if left on his own. There could be natural food for me to eat all around me, and I'd still starve to death. I don't know what to do. He's created this place where there's a bunch of other Americans there who've made it so easy for us, who have given us this amazing handbook to tell us every single thing we need. And we can go in there prepared. And so that when we go there, We can focus on the service. We can focus on the ministry because it's going to be challenging enough to be living in a 700 square foot apartment surrounded on both sides by 24 teenage Ugandan girls and having them around me all the time, except when they go to school. 7 days a week, 2 years of this. That's the kind of peace that comes from that passes all kinds of logical understanding from my point of view. I'll tell you that right now. I've had to learn this. But in the process of learning this and experiencing this peace and that kind of a thing, what I've come to realize is that Sandra and I are not going alone. We are not going alone. You guys are going there with us. And Rick has said this, you know, it's that they are sending us. I mean, Sherry, we're with Sherry. Sherry goes to Mozambique, I'm there with her. When Stephanie was there, I was there with her. Luke and Krista, I'm there with them. You know, it's just, that's the way it is. And you're there with us. And as we've gone through this, we feel your prayers. We see things working out. We know what the prayers have been. We know because we've shared the details. We know how things are coming together. They're coming together with our children. They're coming together with our families. They're coming together with our plans. They're coming together with all kinds of things. And so as we go through the confusion and the chaos of our very strong emotions right now, we have the peace. We have the peace that comes from knowing that we serve the God who created this universe, and he talks with us, and he comes to us, and he blesses us. But we also have the peace of his community. We have the peace of his community that he has created in you. And it's just something that we are very thankful for. It's something that we definitely want to share with you and something that we hope that you appreciate that you have given to us because we definitely feel it. And so thank you so much. Thank you so much for this chance to be able to stand in front of you. Thank you so much for this opportunity to be able to serve you. It's just 2 years. We'll be back. We're coming back in May. We're going to be back around Christmas. But thank you. Thank you so much. So let's go ahead and close in prayer. God, I just thank you for the opportunity to be able to share today. I thank you for the opportunity to be able to talk about your word. I thank you that you speak through your word, and my prayer is that there's something somewhere in all this confusing babble that I've had today, that someone will get something out of this that your spirit will be able to use so that they will draw closer to you. I pray that they will begin to understand you despite all the confusion and chaos in this world. I pray that they will experience you and the way that you talk with us, in the way that you come to us, and that the way that you bless us. And I pray that they will experience your peace, your shalom, your completeness, your total satisfaction. And I ask all of this in your son's name. Amen.